Well, it's certainly good to have you here. I've wanted to talk to you for a long time.
Thanks.
And I really enjoyed Guardian Angel.
Oh, good. Thank
you. It was a lot of fun to read. I noticed in some of the publicity material there's a dossier that lists all of the various characteristics of your private detective. I thought maybe we would talk about that a little bit before we go into some background. In addition to the documentation here, I noticed that your heroine also takes a lot of baths and throws up quite a bit, too.
Some reader wrote an anonymous letter saying, I just cannot take the number of times that you mention VI or your heroine vomiting and puking. If you do not stop this, I will never buy another book. And then didn't sign his, her, its name, which I think is always kind of cowardly. Because I do write back to everyone.
You write back?
Yes.
That's interesting, isn't it? You referred to the book that I wrote. I got letters from all over the country.
Oh, I bet you heard from everyone who
incredible.
Was a Mencken fan.
I did. I was invited to join the Mencken Society in Baltimore and to speak before it.
And did you get a lot of criticism for things you got wrong about Mencken?
An enormous amount. Uh-huh. It's amazing. People would claim they liked the book, but they would find something wrong
right.
with it.
Right, yes.
And I think one of the things they missed is that it was fiction.
Uh-huh.
You know, I wasn't writing a scholarly book any more than Guardian Angel is a scholarly uh-huh. book, although there's a lot of things about junk bonds and so forth, but I imagine somebody will say, well, this couldn't possibly be correct. But in a way, doesn't that miss the point?
Yes, you're not reporting or writing history. That's why you write fiction, so that you don't have to do all the research and get all the details right. You're making them up.
At the same time, there has to be enough correctness in the book to make it credible.
Well, I think what you're trying to do is to create something that feels like a credible world, to create fantasy that works like reality. Stuart Kaminsky talks about this a lot, and I think he's right. If you would actually tape somebody's conversation and print it as dialogue, it would be the most dreary, unreadable stuff you could imagine. In fact, I remember when the Nixon tape transcripts were published, you couldn't follow the conversation because you had to be there and see the grunts and the body language to give it continuity. So dialogue is not the way real people talk. It's a way of trying to create a character who sounds like a real person talking.
Yeah, and when you overhear dialogue, you hear a lot of digressions and superfluous comments, whereas in a book such as your novel, you have to keep the action moving. I mean, the dialogue has to have a point.
And you can't have partial sentences, you know, and trail off, and then everybody nods sympathetically, oh, yes, we know what you're talking about. You can't articulate the thought, but we know the context. Real dialogue has to be, if not whole sentences, at least coherent thoughts.
And yet I was sitting in this little restaurant on the Upper West Side called Ollie's, and the tables are about 3 inches apart, and there were two young women sitting next to me, and I was reading a paper trying to ignore them, but you couldn't miss this conversation. It was so fascinating because one of the women apparently did per diem work for CBS News. And was about to be sent to Moscow to do some research work for a story that they were working on. And she had met a young man in Washington and had gone to Spain with him. But he got married. But he was being posted in Moscow, but would frequently come back to Washington where she would visit him. And they were going to have another meeting in Spain at some point because she thought she would stop off on the way. It was fascinating listening to this, you know, and the other woman was in therapy, and she had the notion that she had to be kind to herself, so every day she would put a post-it note she would put on her bathroom mirror. She would say, do a favor for yourself today, or do something nice for someone else, or something like that, you know.
Uh-huh.
She had a project every day, you know, it's one of these, like, pop therapy. And you're sitting there, and it's absolutely fascinating.
Yes.
And I wanted to take notes.
Yes, yes.
Because I thought, this is dialogue I could use.
Yes, it's wonderful. It's not like, I was thinking, besides having smoking and no smoking sections in restaurants, they should have business or no business. Because I just can't stand to be in a section where it's all lawyers talking about insurance settlements and real estate deals and wanted professional associations to join to find more clients.
How about a section called None of Your Business? Well, let's get back to Orshovsky, VI, surveillance report. Let's talk a little bit about her and what kind of woman she is, because I notice she's aging.
Yes.
She's not staying the same age year after year.
Yes, I made the decision that she had to grow old in time because the first book, which I really wrote, not with a series in mind, but trying to prove that I could write a novel and wanting to do one with a woman hero, I didn't think a lot about who she was or how to develop her as a character, but I had her coming, being shaped by the kind of upheavals of the 60s, although she's 5 years younger than I am, coming out of much the same milieu. And when someone's character is defined by those events, it then becomes pretty artificial to keep them the same age, especially because my books tend to be rather topical, possibly the kinds of books that people will not read 50 years from now because the events are just so very current and contemporary. But she has to age because of that setting, because of how her character was defined, and because she's responding to reality.
And it does make her seem more real, too. Is there more credible than a character in a series novel who is caught in a time warp?
It's sort of funny. I enjoy rereading Rex Stout. I like Nira Wolfe and Archie Goodwin and their kind of fantasy world on West, is it 35th Street? And yet you notice that over time, I mean, they don't change in a way. They don't age. But Archie becomes more and more like Wolfe. He stops being the brash, smart aleck who doesn't know any food or anything intellectual, and becomes, has Wolf's mannerisms and has a lot of his erudition. And it's a pity that they lose their distinctive voices. And I think when you're not letting your characters age and change in those ways, then there are other things that happen to them that you're not as aware of that make them seem less real.
Now, Guardian Angel is the sixth.
It's the seventh.
The seventh in the series, and it began in 88?
The first book was published in 1982 by, was Indemnity only. And they've come out, I guess, there have been seven. I've written seven in 13 years is what it really is. There have been seven published in 10 years.
Now, over the 10 years that Orshovsky has been in existence, how has she changed since that first book?
In the first book, she was really a pioneer. She was essentially the first woman private investigator, at least in contemporary fiction. We'd been starting to see some changes in women's roles in fiction with Carolyn Heilbrun, with I think it was in The Final Analysis, was her first Amanda Cross novel, published in 66, maybe. And there had been a number of ways of making women as women protagonists who were stronger, more fleshed-out characters than, say, Jane Marple. But V.I. was the first woman who was really a professional private investigator. And when you're the first person doing a job in a traditionally closed field, you really take a lot of pressure. When I was a manager for a large insurance company for almost 10 years, and there were a lot of guys who were very supportive of us being there, but there were a lot who felt quite affronted by having women move out of their traditional clerical support roles and into management ranks. And they just pushed on us as hard as they could to see if they could make us crack up. And when we had a very able woman who was promoted, the first woman in the insurance industry promoted to a senior staff position, my boss came to me and said he had a bet with some of the other guys to see how long it would be before he could make her cry in public. So when there are people who are pushing on you to see if they can make you crack up or cry in public, you have a much tougher, more abrasive edge, because you can't afford to let your guard down, because the last thing you want to do is to show them that they're getting under your skin and that you are cracking. Well, when she was the first out there, well, she was a pioneer. She was having to prove that she had a right to be there and to do the job. Now that isn't true anymore, and it would be a cliche if I kept going back to that. first of all, she's not the only fictional character. There are many, many out there. Second, the real world around us has changed so much. You see women in law enforcement. We have a woman on the Supreme Court. You see women all over the criminal justice system. So it would be sort of silly for her to keep telling people, you know, well, you're a girl. Girls can't do this. And she says, well, you know, just try me and I'll show you. All those issues are, at least in her world, resolved. She has a reputation. She may come in for some ridicule by side characters, but not in the mainstream of her work. So in some ways she's softer, and in some ways because she's focused on what are more fundamental issues than the right to do a job, in some ways she's angrier and harder.
But she does indeed meet the villains, and even some of the characters who aren't villains but who are skeptical of her, on equal terms in
yes.
Guardian Angel.
Yes.
I mean, and I think the men in the book see her as equal.
Yes, there's not an effort to patronize her. The people who worry about her because they're her friends and they care about her safety. They don't worry about her competence to do what she's doing.
But she is cocky and she is abrasive.
Well, she's a good South Side Chicagoan I had her grow up in a part of the city. South Chicago is where the steel industry used to be when the United States had a steel industry. And it's always been where successive new waves of immigrants come, or it used to be historically, because it's where jobs were. So it's always been an area of tremendous racial and interethnic fighting. And my stepsons had friends who grew up down there and grew up in those schools, and the girls fought just as much as the boys did. I mean, if you were a girl, you either got a boyfriend who looked after you, you were sent to a convent school and kept under lock and key, or you learned to fight and stand up for yourself. And I used to meet some of these young women. They were very physically able, and I wanted her to have a natural kind of background in street fighting rather than to have her have some arcane skill as a karate expert or jiu-jitsu or some one of those things.
So she knows how to break a few kneecaps.
Yes, and she's not above doing it.
It's a real Chicago novel, too. You mentioned so many places and streets. In some respects, I wish there had been a little map. So if I don't know Chicago, I'd like to have followed it, but I got the feel of it. The feel of the ethnic neighborhoods and the bars and the restaurants and things like that. So you must be very close to the city.
Chicago is a city, I suppose probably any large city is, but it's real heart and soul are in the neighborhoods, not in the glitzy kind of downtown stuff. I mean, Chicago has the population of Manhattan, a little bit bigger than Manhattan, but it's spread out in something like 10 or 15 times the space. So you have the financial stuff and the Madison Avenue stuff along the lakefront, and then everything is spread out in the neighborhoods. People who live on the south side don't go north. I worked with a guy who had to leave work one day to bail out a younger brother who'd been arrested on the north side because his father had never been north and was too scared to go up and find his kid on the north side of the city. But I came to Chicago, I was 19, in the summer of 1966, and I did community service work on the city's southwest side. And it was a very vital, dynamic time in the city, a time of a lot of hope. It was the summer that Martin Luther King marched there for open housing. And it was a time when we thought a lot was possible that we haven't actually achieved. And the little neighborhood where I worked, which was just a nice, ordinary, blue-collar neighborhood, now has the highest murder rate of any square mile anywhere in America. I mean, higher than Washington, Harlem, Detroit. And watching the lives of these sort of ordinary people be just undermined and destroyed by very impersonal political and real estate and banking concerns.
I'm a little confused. How are the lives being destroyed by the real estate?
All of these nice little bungalows. First, there was a lot of development talk and there were a lot of under the table deals, forcing, you know, things happen in neighborhoods like, one case I know about where a bunch of cops are involved in an arson for hire gang and then block any investigation into arson. This drives property values down and then developers can buy the land or the housing cheap. But the development plans for that particular corridor never materialized. Then there was a lot of block busting and redlining and a lot of preying on people's racial fears. And real estate companies made a fortune, and the area turned even further into a slum than it had already been turned by the development scams. And you watch people and you say, okay, this person is being a racist, they're terrible, but they're very helpless. They have one thing in life, their little house. They don't have any power, they don't have any connections, and they don't have any way of getting outside this and seeing what's happening to them. They're just reacting viscerally. Watching those kinds of things go on, as an outsider, you see them, I think, more than someone who might have grown up in the city. So I guess my interest in Chicago has always been in its neighborhoods and what happens to ordinary people in the neighborhoods.
Now, in Guardian Angel, the heavies are predominantly white-collar people. But you mentioned the murder rate, and I'd like to ask you a little bit about this syndrome of violence we have in this country, which seems to be... Richard Bausch has just published a novel called Violence, and it's set in Chicago. It's a wonderful, wonderful novel in which a young man interrupts a convenience store robbery, which turns murderous and emerges as a kind of hero, although he doesn't see himself as one. And so Bausch wanted to study the impact of this violent incident on the lives of the people who were involved in it. We have homicide rates that are reaching epidemic proportions in almost every major city today.
Yes.
Motion pictures show violence as if it's an everyday occurrence, and apparently that's exactly what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
We walk our streets, and I'm very careful. I look around because you never know who's going to walk behind you or a group of suspicious-looking people ahead of you. Maybe I should cross the street.
Right.
I was talking to Michael Crichton yesterday. He wrote a novel about... It was about a murder mystery, too, by the way, but it has all of these Japanese overtones, and he's been to Japan many times. He's in Japan. You can walk the street and not have any sense of impending doom or violence at all.
Mm-hmm.
But when he gets back to the United States, he senses it.
Yes.
What's going on here? Why? It's never been as bad as I can recall.
Yes, I know. Boy, if I had the answer to that question, maybe I could think of an answer to way of fixing it. I mean, I think we're terribly fragmented as a society, and we've sort of created now a self-perpetuating subculture. If you look at city statistics, I think 1 in 2 black men in Washington does time in jail. In Chicago, it's 1 in 3. I don't know what it is in New York City. So you're doing something that, I mean, you're already setting up a milieu in which the expectation is that you will go to jail, and then you get young kids for whom a rite of passage becomes a jail sentence. And you get young kids for whom a rite of passage becomes doing something very violent. And I can see that, and I can sort of see how we went into a downward spiral and got ourselves into that fix. Then at the same time, though, it seems to me that white-collar crime has also become more vicious, more widespread, that people lack a sense of responsibility, of any kind of social responsibility, towards the world around them, and that it becomes all right to rip people off in any way that you can manage. In a way, I think Richard Nixon was sort of a paradigm for this when he was on David Frost, the first interview that he did after he resigned and was in seclusion for a while. And he said that he never did anything wrong because he was never convicted of a crime. I mean, there's such a total divorcement between understanding, anything that he did in any kind of moral or personal terms of moral or personal responsibility. But why we're in this fix, I wish I understood. I feel very helpless and very depressed from it.
I'm not so concerned about the white-collar crime. I'm not saying it's justified, but there are ways to fight back at white-collar crime. What I'm worried about is getting into the elevator of my building on the west side and having a drug addict enter with me and shooting me to rob $5 out of my wallet. It's this brutal, casual street crime that in which all of our lives are in danger. White-collar criminal will embezzle funds from us, but to stab us and to shoot us, he's not doing that. So I'm more worried about the violence.
Well, I think one worries about it certainly at a personal level for personal safety, but when I read about something like Charles Keating, target marketing elderly depositors, getting them to trade in their federally insured certificates of deposit to buy junk and telling them that the two are equivalent, only the junk pays more, then I have to wonder, does anybody know how many of those people now are living in the streets, now have committed suicide, you know, now maybe in jail because elderly committing robberies in order to meet ends meet is certainly an increasing phenomenon. So I feel like white-collar crime can cause great damage in people's lives, but at such a remove that we don't think of it as serious.
Well, you certainly think of it as serious, and indeed it's the key to the crimes in Guardian Angel. There was, parenthetically, none of the presidential administrations in my memory have addressed these social problems of drug addiction and guns and crime. And I don't even see any candidate, potentially, who is going to, with the possible exception of Cuomo. But if there could only be a candidate who would say, my agenda is to deal with America's social problems, and I am going to have a domestic agenda. For the first time, I'm going to call the best minds of our generation to sit down. I'm going to have a blue ribbon panel. I'm going to hold hearings. We're going to create an agenda and try to find out what's wrong with our society and formulate steps to try to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's never been done.
Mm-hmm.
Something has to be done.
Well, maybe Daniel Patrick Moynihan could do it. He seems to think along these lines.
Isn't he the old benign neglect theorist?
Is he?
Yes, that was what he had recommended for urban blacks, is to benign neglect. Don't you recall that controversy when he was an advisor to which administration was it? Eisenhower? I believe it was the Eisenhower administration.
I thought he was the person who really looked at and pinpointed what we were doing to create the black underclass 25 years ago and caused so much uproar and became a pariah.
I don't know. Moynihan has lived a long, loud silence. He's our senior citizen, and we go months without hearing from him. We have no idea what he's doing. Well, let's go back to Warshawski. There was a movie version. Were you involved in that at all?
Kathleen Turner was in it. Right, No, I went on the set a few times, and I had a chance to meet Kathleen and found her very dynamic and engaging, but I really wasn't involved in the process of making the movie at all.
Was that based on a specific novel? Or?
No, they bought the rights to the character and they wrote their own story. They used a few episodes from some of my novels, but they really pretty much rolled their own.
That movie had some problems, though, didn't it?
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
I hadn't seen the movie, but it seems to me it had a lot of mixed reviews.
Well, I think that, they had a sort of a disappointing storyline. I thought Kathleen was very strong, very effective. I also couldn't help wondering, it's hard for people, I think, to acknowledge a strong woman on the screen, and that was one of the problems that they had with the script. They couldn't make up their minds whether to go for it wholeheartedly. I learned interestingly enough, that Hollywood, not just Disney, that they use focus groups to help them edit their movies. So they make a movie, but they don't really, it's not done until they've done 17 or 30 iterations in front of focus groups. And who knows what population segment they take, but I think it's an extraordinary way to undertake an allegedly creative effort to see. People apparently liked more slapstick and less serious drama, so they edited out character development and serious drama and cut 20 minutes out of the film and went for the lighter stuff. And it was clear that whatever market testing they were doing didn't reflect the tastes of the population at large. But it's probably why they keep making the same movie over and over again that nobody wants to see.
That reminds me of the episode back in the 30s. Somebody tried to figure out what titles sell books.
Uh-huh.
And they found out that a book with the title Lincoln in it usually sold books. A book that had dog in the title would sell books. And a book that had doctor in it would sell books. So somebody wrote a novel entitled it Lincoln's Doctor's Dog. It didn't sell. Well, how did you become interested in detective fiction, or was this an accident?
Oh, I don't know. I think being a lover of detective novels is like being an eater of oysters. You can't explain it. It's an idiosyncratic taste. I've been reading them for as long as I can remember. I mean, started as a child and never stopped. So when I wanted to try to write a novel, I turned to the form that I knew the best. I have not read a lot of so-called mainstream fiction, so I'm not very comfortable with it.
Who are some of the mystery writers that you have admired who might have been an influence on you?
Well, the people that I admired for their writing skill, people like Dorothy Sayers, for instance, or Marjorie Allingham, right out of an experience so different from America that I don't think that their work was that strong an influence on me. In some ways, when I started my first book, I was writing in reaction to people like Raymond Chandler, although I admire a lot about his writing and a lot about his character. When you look at American crime fiction, the hard-boiled school, which is really the American contribution to the form, what you see is women portrayed in ways that are very difficult for a woman reader to respond to or identify with. In six of Chandler's seven novels, it's a sexually active woman who's the main cause of all the evil that goes on. And you keep seeing this over and over again. In contemporary novels, you'll see that women are often prostitutes, that's the main role that they play in books, and that they don't have very highly developed moral senses, that they're just not as developed as human beings as men are. So I wanted to write in that American school because it's Chicago. I mean, it just captures the urban drama that Chicago certainly is part of. But I wanted to have a woman who was as wholly realized as I could make her, and whose sexuality didn't define her moral character as it so often seems to in fiction.
But men don't come off well in many of the hard-boiled detective stories. I mean, they're always the villains too. They're the thugs. They're greedy, diabolical. And are usually brought down by the lead character, who is tough in his own way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're right. I think you're right that women in the older hard-boiled novels had become stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
But many of the heavies also are stereotypes, too. But it could be because people like Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, they kind of set the standard that everybody else followed.
Yeah, I think poor Hammett suffered from having actually worked as a private investigator. And it's funny that his books don't seem to be as contemporary as Chandler's, who was totally, you know, his were total myths, total fictions. Hammett kept trying to bring reality the reality of the private investigator's life in.
Do you read Elmo Leonard?
Yes, I think he's a very fine writer. And Lauren Estelman, another Detroit writer, is really quite a skilled craftsman. Marcia Muller, to my mind, is one of the finest writers that we have doing crime fiction today, a really professional writer's writer. I always think of her and Lauren Estelman together because they seem to me to have the same kind of level of craft.
Now, didn't you form an organization of women mystery writers?
Well, it's an organization called Sisters in Crime. It's really an organization for readers, writers, editors, booksellers. It's not, out of our 1,200 members internationally, probably a sixth are writers and the rest are readers.
Do you meet, have a newsletter, or what? How does it work?
Oh, there's a newsletter that comes out a couple of times a year. We try to meet, but of course, when you're spread that diversely, you don't meet often. We meet at there are two annual mystery conventions, one in New York around the awarding of the Edgars in May, and then one that roams around the country in different spots in October, and we try to meet then. But people get together in local chapters and really work together much more on local levels than we do nationally.
And what is the thrust of the group? What are your interests?
I'd say that it's really Sisters in Crime is really about women helping women. It's a networking organization. It helps give women a sense of confidence in their writing voices. I think particularly in the Northwest, I look at the number of new women writers coming out of the Bay Area who've really found the kind of support they needed to believe in themselves as writers and make that happen for themselves. One of the things that we focused on early was that books by women were very much underrepresented in reviews compared to books by men. That if you were a man writing a book, you had about seven times the probability of getting your book reviewed than if you were a woman. And, of course, not all books are good enough to have attention paid to them, but we couldn't believe that men were really writing seven times as well as the average man, writing seven times as well as the average
Could
woman.
Maybe that there are seven true. Times more male writers. Than,
no, I mean, this is adjusted for the women made up about a third of the crime fiction, but about 6% of the reviews.
So why do you suppose this is?
Oh, I think that it comes from a couple of reasons. We sort of believe that stories that are more masculine are more universal, and stories that we think of as more feminine are for women only. You know, it's like the Western is the great American movie, but a romance is a lady's tearjerker kind of attitude. I think Sue Grafton and I got tremendous review attention from the beginning because we were writing in what's traditionally been a very masculine field, the hard-boiled field. It wasn't that we were necessarily better or more wonderful than a lot of other women writing, but we were doing something that appealed to what was seen as more mainstream, more universal because it was more masculine. And One of the things that, well, of course, reviews are important because it's library sales that make or break you when you're a starting writer. I mean, my first book sold 3,500 copies. It needed 3,000 to break even, and 2,500 copies went to libraries. So if I hadn't had my reviews, libraries would never have heard of me, and they wouldn't have bought the books, and Dial would never have asked for a second novel. So it's really sort of a make it or break it situation for a starting writer. And for whatever reason, a lot of women just aren't seen as important enough to pay that kind of attention to. So we've sort of circumvented the process by going directly to libraries and bookstores and making our members available, making information about who's writing available. And what we're finding is that whether they're good writers, bad writers, or or just somewhere in the middle, that there's a lot, there are a lot of readers who are really eager and excited to see these books, and that there's sort of been outside the standard kind of literary process of delivering books through the New York Times and Publishers Weekly and so on out to distributors, that by going around on the outside of it and creating awareness of some of these writers, that we're actually doing publishers a favor by greatly increasing the markets.
Well, maybe it's time for you to break a few kneecaps. Well, to wrap things up, Sarah Paresky, what is ahead for VI and for yourself?
I wish I knew what was ahead for VI. It would make my life a little easier right now. I know there's some problems that she has to resolve on the personal level. Guardian Angel leaves things up in the air with her oldest friend, Lottie Herschel. They've had a bit of an estrangement that has to be resolved. I have to figure out what she's going to do with the policeman lover she's acquired in the new book, Conrad Rawlings. He can't stay around forever because a private eye and a cop are inevitably going to be on opposite sides of some issue. But what I have to figure out is what that issue is.
But you're going to do it.
Well, I hope so. God is willing and the creek don't rise.
Guardian Angel, terrific book by Sarah Paresky. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Don.